Good morning and welcome everyone to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Dermot McDonald sitting in for Brendan this morning on this, our final panel discussion before Christmas. It's 1 week to Christmas, but Santa, it seems, has delivered for most, if not all, of the cabinet who have remained in situ. It is that lack of change in the new cabinet that has dominated the newspaper coverage this morning. Varadkar bets on more of the same. That's the lead for the Sunday Independent, which says that the coalition is gambling on stability over change, making minimal alterations to their ministerial teams following the handing over of power between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. The paper has a brilliant picture by David Conachy of Taoiseach Leo Varadkar standing before the Christmas tree at government buildings with his arms outstretched, palms up towards the sky. I don't know if it's in prayer or some sort of an appeal, and maybe it's all of that hope and housing that he's holding in his hands. For the Sunday Times, their off lead is Varadkar is back, with pomp but no surprises. That paper dedicates its lead story to the murder of Private Sean Rooney in South Lebanon. John Mooney, its crime and security respondent, reports that the young Irish soldier was shot dead by Hezbollah to try to deter the UN from patrolling villages where the terrorists store weapons and plan their attacks. He was citing authorities in his report. But for its part, the Sunday Independent says that Private Sean Rooney may have been targeted after being mistaken for Israeli soldiers. The Irish Mail on Sunday carries harrowing details of a final message sent by soldiers in the vehicle driven by Private Sean Rooney. "Don't come back, it's too late," was the final message sent to comrades in the second vehicle of the two-vehicle convoy after they were separated just minutes earlier. The Business Post goes for energy for its lead. It says government will consider capping prices on energy bills in policy U-turn. Capping energy bills this winter was ruled out last September, just ahead of the budget, but the government will consider placing a price cap in the new year, according to a report by Daniel Murray. For the tabloids, It's Gone to War is the lead for the Irish Sun on Sunday, which is images of Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar kitted out in soccer jerseys, World Cup style. The paper also quotes Green Party leader Eamon Ryan, who said, "It's like half time and the captain's armband is passed on." "I've Lost a Brother" is the headline in the Irish Sunday Mirror, where Christopher O'Neill describes his heartbreak and learning on the death of his best friend, Private Sean Rooney. Christopher tells the paper that Sean Rooney was the most kind-hearted, caring person in the world. For the Sunday World, Lord of the Blings is the lead in an exclusive by Nicola Tallant on a raid in the UK on the home of an Irish mob boss, which discovered over £500,000 worth of goods, including lots of shoes. The Daily Star Sunday has what it describes as an other world exclusive. It's a front page exclusive about how the late great singer George Michael has been in touch with a psychic to tell the world he's no longer feuding with Barry Manilow. Gotta Have Faith is the headline on that, and I don't really have much more to say about that. Across the Irish Sea, strikes of all kinds dominate the front pages of UK newspapers this morning. The Chief of the Defence Staff has told the Sunday Telegraph that armed forces are not spare capacity for striking workers, while the Observer reports that nurses have pledged tougher new strikes throughout January amid fears that the NHS could collapse over Christmas and the New Year. I think there's a deadline of this Thursday for talks to conclude on that. Well, to discuss that and so much more, I am joined by my panel, Grainne Nier, Dublin reporter at the Press Association, by Noel Rock, former Fine Gael TD and Director of Public Affairs at Red Flag, by Declan Power, Security and Defence Analyst, and by Dr Emma Howard, Economist and Lecturer at TU Dublin. You're all very, very welcome. I won't ask you about George Michael and Barry Manilow and that great row being resolved just yet. But I might first of all go to you, Noel Rock, because you're not in studio with us this morning because COVID is still with us. It's still with you in any event.
I'm afraid so, yeah. 2 years in, COVID is still with us, so I'm working from home today with you on the newspaper panel to discuss all the news about the cabinet reshuffle, but with COVID, unfortunately, yes.
And are you doing okay? Because I know you missed your Christmas party and everything.
Yeah, I did indeed, but no, I'm absolutely fine, to be totally honest. It's no worse than a mild cold in my case, but you'd be very, very conscious of the timing, and if anybody caught it from me, Christmas could potentially be scuppered for them. So for now, I'm happy to stay indoors and stay safe.
Were you testing, Noel, or you know, because a lot of people have sort of given up maybe at this stage, but how did you even find out?
Yeah, I felt a small bit under the weather, so I had a bit of a cold, and so I had taken the precaution of kind of testing every day And I was clear on Wednesday and clear on Thursday. But then Friday came and suddenly I was grounded. So I think there is a virtue in still testing if you don't feel particularly well.
Yeah.
I know there's lots of bugs and colds and flus going around right now. But obviously the difference with COVID is it's so highly contagious, and it's still so highly contagious that you can pass it on very, very easily to people. So I think there is a virtue if you do have tests still at home.
Well, you signed well, thank God. So we're going to put you to good work and ask you, first of all, your thoughts, and obviously as a former TD, looking across all of the acres of coverage in the papers this morning, what has struck you about some of the coverage, or at least the tone of it this morning?
Well, I've never had more time to read the papers, first of all. But absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely acres of coverage this morning. And the main theme, it seems to me, is continuity, certainly. Now, there's a bit of a tone in the newspapers of a boredom with that continuity. But in terms of picking this cabinet selection, it's quite clear that each of the three component parties of the coalition, the Greens, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, all place a value on the continuity of personnel within the cabinet, not necessarily within the exact same departments, but in many cases in the same departments. And I think Jodie Corcoran has
the most controversial ones as well.
Yeah, indeed. Health and housing obviously would be lightning rods for criticism. But I think it would be fair to say that the personnel aren't necessarily being blamed there, i.e. the ministers aren't necessarily being blamed. There's simply an acknowledgement in the public arena that the challenges still exist there, and that there's a frustration that more headway isn't being made on them. So you'd have to ask yourself, what is the virtue of changing the personnel in that case? As Jodie Corcoran points out in the Sunday Independent on page 10, you know, there's little point in changing ministers for the sake of it. It takes a lot of time to read into these briefs. And actually, by changing a minister simply for the sake of it, you could end up slowing down progress ultimately, or you could end up stymieing potential solutions that are already in the pipeline. So I think to replace either now would have been a risk to further slow down that process. So I think continuity, all things considered, is probably a reasonable thing to aspire to. And it's quite clear that at junior minister level, the Green Party have flagged that they intend on making no changes at senior or junior ministerial level. So we might not see any changes from the Green Party whatsoever, it would seem. From Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, I mean, the junior ministers are announced on Tuesday. You might see a little bit more change there. For instance, there'd be very natural knock-on effects. Micheál Martin has gone to the Department of Foreign Affairs. The European Affairs Minister was a Fianna Fáil person. It would seem natural that would now rotate to a Fine Gael person, and people will be talking about the likes of Neil Richmond, very, very strongly connected with that. So that would make a kind of a logical sense. And there's a logical knock-on effect in departments where senior ministers have changed party, that junior ministers might also change party as well.
Grainne, when you look across perhaps closest to what's happening in UK politics in the last couple of years, perhaps stability, lack of change and, just that mundane kind of sense of stability, is that something perhaps that people are maybe slightly relieved at?
Yeah, I saw Julian Smith, the former Northern Ireland secretary, retweet a photo of the new cabinet and express his appreciation, I suppose, of how undramatic the whole thing was. And I think that's the most striking thing about the reshuffle, that it is undramatic. You know, 100 years ago you had a civil war, and these were the two parties that emerged from it. And there's basically almost no drama about swapping people around. There was a little bit of wrangling over Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue a couple of months ago over the Eurogroup presidency, but even that was very, very minor. And you have kind of it all coming down to the junior ministries. For the average person, I don't know how much they will care who is in a junior ministerial role, but for the senior,
for the people in the parties, it's hugely important.
Yeah, but and it gives, I suppose, talented people in the party an opportunity to gain experience for more senior ministries later. So it gives you maybe a hint of where the party is going, or you know, what senior figures are coming to the fore. But also for the average person, I do think changing the look of the cabinet can help give the government, I suppose, a bit more space and a bit more time, and it takes the pressure off from the public over health and housing, because it gives the impression of change. And I do think that they could have done more than they have, but I suppose that's kind of a mostly a something that will be needed to be done in hindsight. I think it's most, again, the most striking thing is just how the two parties have, particularly Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, obviously, have passed over this change of power quite easily. And there's a piece in the Sunday Business Post by Michael Brennan and Daniel Murray, which sums it up quite well, where he says the likes of Barry Cowan, John McGuinness and Eamon O'Cleave, the grandson of Eamon de Valera, calling out Thaw to vote Varadkar in as Taoiseach. Like, that's quite an extraordinary moment when you think about it.
What was it extraordinary for you, Emma?
Yeah, I think actually, so John Lee has a piece in the Mail on Sunday, which I think highlighted one of the most extraordinary things I thought yesterday, which was the standing ovation for Micheál Martin from Sinn Féin and the
rest. A strategic one?
Well, so that's what he's wondering about, because, you know, it was also kind of interesting. Mary Lou McDonald's exchange with Micheál Martin was quite, you know, jovial, and she reserved her bitter words for Leo Varadkar yesterday. You know, John Lee is saying, given Sinn Féin's kind of slow in the rise in their support, is it perhaps the case that there's a softening of that relationship between Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin in a way that there is not with Sinn Féin and Fine Gael? So, you know, the Emer Higgins, when she was seconding Leo Varadkar for Taoiseach, you know, she called out the opposition as being bitter and divisive. So he is suggesting that perhaps yesterday's historic events may be repeated in the future with a rotating Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin Taoiseach.
Yeah, do you think that? Because, you know, Mary Lee McDonald reserved her cordiality and everything for Micheál Martin. It was a slightly different story when it came to Leo Varadkar. But do you think it was a strategic or sincere appreciation for Micheál Martin? Are they looking ahead potentially to the next electoral cycle? I'm wondering, will there be a rotating Taoiseach system there?
Perhaps. But I think in the case of the direct line on Micheál Martin, I think there was a genuine appreciation that he had been a steady hand on the tiller, and that was accepted by most parties. It's well documented, Micheál Martin's antipathy to Sinn Féin and how he had to hold the line about that within his own party. And the chances are he won't be in a position to do much about it if Fianna Fáil are thinking about going into a coalition with them further down the line. So I think that Mary Lou has taken advantage of the opportunity not to come across too bitter and save the bitterness then
for
her main
target.
But
when you look, Declan, the editorial in the Sunday Times says today, like the Dodo, our single party governments have become extinct.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, the day of single party governance in Ireland, I think, ended with Charles J. Haughey. You know, the interesting thing will be if Sinn Féin are looking like they're going to be in government, who we could be surprised at how coalitions could work out, and who might be the senior party or senior partner, and who might be the junior partner. But one additional thing that struck me, while there wasn't much change in the lineup, and I think that was sensible, because Leo is often criticised for being obsessed with optics over the depth of matters. That, you know, what he needs now is a win further down the line. Particularly in housing and health, the two big ones. And he could have been accused of just trying to distract people by having a big shuffle. The one person that I saw didn't get much attention, but I noted John Drennan, I think it was in the Mail on Sunday, had a piece about Simon Harris going to be holding the justice portfolio as well.
For 6 months.
Yeah, and I think it's that could be very interesting to see how that works out for Harris, because I think he's been quietly building a support base to have a tilt at the leadership in Fine Gael. And he seems to be one of the ones who's been steadily rising and been consistent in having a safe pair of hands so far.
Justice will afford a higher profile.
Absolutely,
perhaps other
briefs
haven't given you. Noel Rock, can I bring you in just on that? You know, I think the Sunday Independent, we love report cards. We love seeing who gets graded. But when you look at it, there's only one person who's got an A, and that is Micheál Martin. And, it was the historically perhaps the shortest tenure of a Taoiseach, but he arguably really has put his stamp on it in terms of the tone and what he's brought to it, with even Leo Varadkar saying he's learned a lot from his style of Taoiseach. And it's interesting, given all of the, it feels like for the last 2.5 years we've been talking about various heads within Fianna Fáil and will he be ousted, and yet here he is as he leaves the office of Taoiseach with really high personal ratings, if they haven't translated to the party.
Absolutely. And I mean, the A is, in the opinion of many, well deserved. And I think maybe that that grade is somewhere reflected in the standing ovation that was afforded to him by, I think, all parties, essentially. Certainly many of the opposition parties stood to give him a standing ovation at conclusion. So I think there is a virtue in perhaps reflecting on the political pragmatism and skill that he's shown throughout his career. I mean, he was first elected in 1989 to the Dáil. Yeah. And first brought to cabinet under Bertie Ahern's first government in 1997. So, you know, he has had a tremendous run. He's shown great patience, which is always a virtue as well in terms of waiting to get to this office. And then obviously when he got to the office, he was blown around by headwinds that he couldn't have possibly anticipated. COVID, Ukraine, inflation, cost of living. And he's managed to keep a steady hand on the tiller throughout that all. I mean, this government has been, after a rocky first 6 months, I think the hallmark of it has been a lack of drama so far. There haven't really been any front page rows between coalition partners, even though there are three coalition partners. Yeah. And this reshuffle kind of, you know, underpins that in a way. No drama, continuity, consistency, which is sort of, I think, the hallmark of Micheál Martin's leadership.
Grainne, it is a style, I suppose, one of de-escalation that Micheál Martin has. It's interesting that the Sunday Times has said at the halfway stage, how has this government performed? Its economic record is very good. Growth remains strong. And while COVID became a health crisis, it didn't really become an economic one, which seems a very, very positive review. It has one big caveat, of course. The government's record on housing is based on the number of dwelling completions, a conspicuous disaster. But it is interesting to see, you know, that, you know, to what extent will he's going to Department of Foreign Affairs. Mm. So Brexit, you know, the Shared Island Initiative that he brought in under his tenure. What do you think he's going to achieve in the next 2.5 years of the coalition?
Just on the point you made about economics, Ireland's economic situation has been made much easier by corporate tax. We might be having a very different conversation about how we funded COVID measures and the cost of living measures if it wasn't for that. So the government are lucky that we're in this period where we are still gaining those taxes. But that's kind of a hypothetical. In terms of Micheál Martin, his biggest power, if you look at these kind of report cards, as like almost top trumps, his biggest skill is diplomacy, really.
The women get most of the D's. I was surprised at that, but go on.
So he will, I think that will be a useful skill in foreign affairs, on the protocol in particular. John Lee writes in the Mail that one criticism of Fianna Fáil for decades has been that they have no ideology or fixed purposes, and that that has allowed them to amass kind of supporters from across society, and that's why they're such a big party. But he adds that what Micheál Martin has done is to manipulate this fluidity for the modern fragmented Dáil, and that really is a good analysis of why he is so the right Taoiseach for the time to unite the Dáil and these three parties, and also the country in times of two very big crises, well, three actually, with the cost of living crisis as well. The challenge is, can Leo Varadkar learn from that? He is he's prone to making kind of dramatic statements that can rattle governments. And I think that is a lesson that Micheál Martin has proven, that you can be kind of a hard leader but also not rattle the cage as well. I think that is, when he says there are things he admired, I do wonder if that is what he's thinking of, because it is the big disparity between the two of them.
That's been very clear recently with remarks Leo Varadkar has made that has just given fuel to the opposition, like, you know, the people who are emigrating because they can't get housing and they can't deal with the cost of living in Ireland, and he's telling them the grass isn't always greener, which, you know, might be fair to some point, but it's not a it's
good
not
argument
a headline
when you're trying to get into power, but it's
exactly. And when, so, you know, yeah, there's certainly something to learn from Micheál Martin's style of leadership that we might see a different Leo Varadkar. What I think is really interesting for both leaders going forward, given, you know, 2 years till the next election, is John Walsh has a piece in the Business Post talking about the fact that really now it's quite hard to discern any coherent ideological difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And that's something that Sinn Féin is playing to as well. You know, that they're all the same. It's essentially the same party.
We're not like the UK. We don't have a very kind of hard left and
we
right.
Don't. No, exactly. And so it's also very interesting because the way the voting patterns are emerging is that, you know, we see from lots of analysis that Kevin Cunningham and others have done on why people are voting for Sinn Féin. Most people are voting for Sinn Féin because they want change. And so it's also now starting to become, people are starting to vote for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil because they don't want Sinn Féin in power. So it's that sort of interesting dichotomy and what's going
stability
to happen.
Stability versus change. Declan, there was a piece that caught my eye, I know caught yours as well, which is kind of interesting in light of the fact that Pascal Donoghue, you know, he got elected to the Eurogroup presidency for a second time unopposed. Was it the farewell to Donoghue, the feeblest minister in 100 years of the Irish state?
Yeah, I thought that was very harsh. I thought it was kind of going for the man as opposed to the ball. So Lucy kind of takes him out, so to speak, from an economic perspective and referencing other economic writers. I think it's unfair. I think Donoghue has been a steadying influence within his portfolio. And I think, to be fair, also a lot of other observers in this area.
And people has worked well with Michael McGrath.
Precisely. He has managed to do something that I think is important, and you've touched on it there, to both be a good steward of the state from an economic and financial perspective, and to also do it in a diplomatic fashion with awareness of the sensitivities, not just between the two parties, and as you say, build a good personal relationship with Michael, but also at a European level. And we see him quite well respected at European level by virtue of the office he now holds there. So I think when you take things, to use that great phrase, take things in the complete round, he's not just done a capable job, but he's acknowledged by many people who are expert in these fields as having done a steadying job.
And as evidence, the last budget, you know, the ESRI and the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council both gave a pretty good assessment of what they'd done in the last budget, which is very unusual.
Yeah, it was just one of those ones that just jumped out. Noel, can I bring you back in there just on whatever it is, an extraordinary personal achievement for Leo Varadkar to come into the office of Taoiseach for a second time. It mightn't be as easy this time round.
No, I mean, like, there are going to be significant challenges and headwinds ahead. So the ones that we talked about briefly earlier on, Ukraine, the remnants of the COVID-19 issue insofar as increased healthcare costs, the inflation crisis, the cost of living crisis. These things are all real challenges. And accordingly, that's why I think it is good that we have someone like Leo Varadkar there who has experience of doing this before, because there'll always be crises in government. Like in his first term, there was the Brexit issue, obviously, was very much hanging over us. And the need to diversify our trade, import and export routes was hanging over us thereafter. And, you know, I think part of the reason why we're doing so well economically, and as Grainne said, can essentially fund the solutions to the cost of living crisis, the inflation crisis and COVID-19, is because we put good foundations in place. And I think the best person to use those good foundations is the existing team of Leo Varadkar, Michael McGrath, Pascal Donoghue. You know, they very much know how to master this modern economy insofar as possible. But there is a challenge there insofar as there is a global headwind blowing. We have been very much the beneficiaries of a corporate tax dividend.
Very much.
Like.
That's a very diplomatic way of placing it there.
just to throw in to amplify a point there that Noel is making, I think Leo Varadkar's ability can only be enhanced on the international stage because Micheál Martin is now going to be Minister for Foreign Affairs. And we're mentioning the headwinds from Ukraine. Micheál Martin has shown himself, if I can paraphrase here, to be sound on the Ukrainian question in a very clear way. And I think he gets it and understands it, perhaps maybe more so even the Leo Varadkar. I think he also will be a very steadying influence with regards to the north of Ireland. And I think that's much needed moving forward. I think unionist politicians would probably trust him more than most. And I think his good offices can be put into good effect there. And then also not forgetting the current maelstrom that has blown up with Lebanon and the death of one of our soldiers. The investigations that are going to come out of this will require appropriate stewardship. And I think Micheál Martin may be the right man in the right place.
Micheál Martin, who, and I think we should now move on to that. I should actually just say that in that report card, in respect of the Ukraine crisis, Roderick O'Gorman has come out very, very well, given the scale of what he's had to deal with in that ministry, but particularly for dealing with the Ukraine crisis. Lebanon, Declan, it must be a very, very personal issue for you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, you know, people of my generation in the military all would have known somebody who was killed in action in Lebanon. And I would have known one particular guy who trained me called Jonathan Campbell, who was killed back in the late 90s. But and then there are others. But there's a few things that are at play here that we need to take note of, and particularly those in the media and body politic. It's bad enough to see people, you know, killed doing something that they trained for and maybe under circumstances that they perhaps expected. Okay, you know, we can suck that up in the defence community. But what we can't suck up is cold-blooded murder. And this is turning rapidly now in the defence community from sorrow and sympathy to seething anger. And you mentioned the headlines. The Sunday Independent...
Because there isn't actually an agreement in the headlines on what the direct cause of it are in terms of the attribution and also just in terms of what supports that they had.
Sure. And there's a couple of things that I just want to nail a few colours to the mast here. So first of all, full disclosure, I wrote an analysis piece for the Sunday Times, giving, I suppose, some broad and depth in conjunction with the piece that John Mooney wrote, which John's piece is very good. It's very well researched. I would know some of the sources he probably talked to, and I know that he went way beyond just Irish sources. And we need to scotch things. The Sunday Independent story is arrant rubbish. I don't say that with any pleasure, but it is rubbish. To be saying that they were mistaken for Israeli soldiers is playing into a trope that has been created by Hezbollah's information operations people.
That was a piece by Ali Bracken.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I think was quoting
sources.
Also Lebanese judicial sources.
Well, look at now. I'd be very careful here on grading sources, and perhaps this is a little bit outside the experience bailiwick of some of the people in the Sunday Independent, and they should maybe reflect on that. But I would also say the Irish media should be very careful and how they handle this, and not be used as an uninformed instrument of Hezbollah propaganda. Because the idea that these men could have been mistaken for Israeli soldiers is nonsense on so many levels.
Well, look, I mean, from
And we need to scotch that. And let's just assume for a brief moment that they did make that mistake, these armed villagers who wouldn't be armed
There are three investigations. So let's assume that all avenues, being pursued.
The Irish state has already shown its lack of confidence in the Lebanese investigation. I'm not the slightest bit surprised, because the Lebanese government is very much a beaten docket. But to go back to the point, if there was such a mistake made, and I put that term in inverted commas, those troops were already combat. They were no threat to anybody by the time they had come under fire and their vehicle had overturned. They were all in various stages of injury when they were cold-bloodedly shot at, and when Private Rooney was cold-bloodedly killed.
Through a rear window or through a back door?
Not the rear windows. Through the rear door was opened. Those vehicles are armoured to the point of withstanding small arms fire up to and including rocket-propelled grenades, RPGs. So they should have survived that. The reason they didn't survive that is because assailants went out of their way to draw blood. Let's be very clear about that. Yeah. They didn't mistake them for Israeli soldiers.
I don't think we're going to attack the journalists who did go out of their way to perform.
I'm not attacking
their
the journalists.
Due diligence in the various newspapers were in the very early stages.
Due diligence is a term that I wouldn't be using here.
Well, look, we're in the early stages still, Declan, of it. But I suppose there was a couple of things I suppose that struck with me yesterday about it, Emma Harden. I know that you grew up in the Curra, and notwithstanding all the research and everything's done at the early stages, but you know, it was a two vehicle convoy. You know, it didn't attract that wider, that bigger piece. But you grew up in the Curra, so you must have a sense of how difficult it must be.
Yeah, so I mean, I completely understand, you know, Declan's upset and passion talking about it, because it's the army. So I have no personal connections. I had no family members in the army, but I know it's a very close knit community. I went to school with lots of kids, primary school with lots of kids whose dads were in the armed forces, and I have lots of abiding memories of their dads going off on tour to Lebanon and Cyprus at the time, and you know, the anticipation of them coming home for Christmas and the excitement about that. And yeah, I mean, just for me, you know, what struck me is just the absolute heartbreak of a mother and a fiance and a family who, you know, were waiting for their loved one to come home, and he's not coming home.
I just want to bring you in there. Obviously, we've no one here from the Sunday Independent to defend themselves or their reporting, but there is no doubt that the political, and Micheál Martin has said it, that there's going to be a strong political drive to get to the heart of this issue. And I suppose it raises questions around our continued and our very, very long-standing presence as peacekeepers in the region.
Absolutely does, yeah. And I think, you know, the The political system has obviously given a reaction to this, and the reaction is one of shock, sorrow and dismay. Like, we definitely do need to make sure that a proper and thorough and reliable investigation takes place where we can establish the facts insofar as possible. And I fully respect and endorse everything Declan said in that regard. But also, obviously, the political system needs to make sure that when having debates going forward about security policy, about things like the triple lock and so on and so forth, and it's not to blur or conflate the issues, but it is to say that these matters have been debated very thoroughly in the public domain in the last 12 months in light of Ukraine, we need to all pause, reflect and remember that even in UN peacekeeping missions, these occurrences can take place and we can lose our citizens. And I think, you know, before any further debates take place on expanding our security presence, we should all bear that in mind in the political system. You know, I think everybody's proud of our UN peacekeeping stance. But certainly there is a question mark over the desire to expand our military presence around the world. And I think that should just be borne in mind.
And Gráinne, you obviously know the now former Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, actually did visit the region. I think it was it last May that he was in the area. Just your thoughts.
It's I think that was one of the most striking things that Simon Coveney said in the aftermath, that this was a journey he himself had been on when he'd visited two or three times in the past 2 years, and that it was a standard run that they were, you know, traveling, bringing one of their colleagues to the airport for compassionate leave. I mean, there are so many tragic aspects to the whole story. And I think the amount of drip feed of information and the possibilities of what happened or what didn't, I think, shows the depth of feeling about the tragedy and the scale of the tragedy, but also how much an investigation is needed and how it does just need to be looked into.
And Declan, we have been there for a long time, but I think what this reminds us of, and you even cited the death of your colleagues in previous missions, is just the risks in that region.
Absolutely. But the nature of the threat has changed. And if we broaden this a little bit and look at it against the backdrop.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the threats, when I was there in the 90s, it was much more kinetic. I mean, there were airstrikes, there were bombardments, there were a lot of threats from Israeli-backed militias. I would say the threat is completely turned on its head, and we have to move with the times and interpret that. From our point of view on the ground, the Israelis are not the threat, or Israeli-backed militias. Hezbollah have become very much the threat. The ordinary Israeli people, Lebanese people, that we had such a good relationship with, that has been largely denuded, if not destroyed, because Hezbollah have consolidated their power down there. And this murder has happened against the backdrop of a campaign of intimidation and confrontation that has been gradually escalating. And accompanying that has been an online and mainstream media campaign to smear UN forces whenever they have been confronted. So you have these masses of civilian people suddenly brought out to deny movement and operation and engage in confrontation. And then the UN are blamed for it.
One of the things that was interesting was that the notion of when you don't get local support for convoys, because obviously this is quite a small convoy.
Yeah.
It was only a two-vehicle convoy. So had it been six vehicles or more, I think it attracts local support. Do you think that needs to change? Because obviously, and I think, as I understand it, it's very easy in Lebanon driving to get for convoys to split.
Well, if this was an operational matter, that would have been much more hard-edged and greater numbers. But this was threat assessments take place all the time. So this wasn't an operational journey. This was a routine admin journey. Two vehicles, lightly armed, dropping the guys to be repatriated for funerals. Even if straying off the motorway, it's not uncommon because the chaotic nature of driving on those motorways, you could get sandwiched into a lane that you can't
very
get out
easily.
Of. You're into a secondary route for maybe 10 minutes. And that's what the guys are trying to do and get back on. And they were in contact with the other car and they were going to RV with them at another point. They come into contact with a bunch of people who started engaging and denying them movement. Now, they're drilled to that would be to get out of there, because the next step would be they could be forcibly disarmed. And in the process of that happening, the fact that they came under fire, in footage that has been shown widely on the internet, shows a form of ambush had been assembled, and then the end result, the murders, as I've outlined already, that indicates something much more sinister.
And a new style.
Exactly.
A new style of combat.
It's hybrid. So it's mixing a style of confrontation with civilians, ostensibly, armed elements that Hezbollah can deny, and then a smear campaign on media, which was happening since Hezbollah denied it. But we have to look at it in the broad background, which is, why would Hezbollah be doing this? And we have to go back to a point the Israelis made when they criticised the UN a few years ago, and we didn't take it on board at the time. They've been claiming that Hezbollah are gearing up to make war in Israel with further deployments of ammunition, building of tunnels and various accoutrements that are required to make war. And this appears to be quite obviously what's happening.
Including obviously...
And it's the UN's job to be able to report on that.
A propaganda one.
And that's why they don't want to let them move. So we have to ask hard questions about what is UNIFIL's presence there now going forward?
So
what's it for?
Will people be asking questions about our continued presence there as peacekeepers?
They will. Now, obviously, it would be completely the wrong thing to turn tail and pull out. And I don't think anybody connected to the defence community would advocate such a thing. But what our government need to do is advocate through UN channels and through the diplomatic relationships we have with the bigger power nations to have a further examination looked at what is UNIFIL's role here and is it able to carry out its role? Because I know from my own experience with the UN missions, both in the Middle East and Africa, sometimes the UN don't want to admit that things have changed or that the threat level and the nature of the threat level has changed, or that they're in the target lines, or that they're not able to do their job because the whole thing can get overturned and they're like a big battleship and they don't like to turn quickly. So we need to bring political pressure to bear on this, and questions need to be asked. If UNIFIL isn't able to do its job, then what is the reason for that mission? Because the Israelis are quite right then when they say we're going to be on the receiving end of attacks there. UN is supposed to be able to stop that by regular reporting, and that was happening up until a few years ago, and it's not happening now.
And Noel, just to bring you back in there, do you think that there will be an evaluation of our presence there? Like, I mean, one of the things we're so used to seeing is, particularly even around this time, is to seeing all of the soldiers coming home, and it's something that is our presence there is something that has a resonance in the minds of the Irish public.
I suspect, like anything, it'll be reviewed, certainly, but I imagine it'll be more along the lines of what Declan said, where there might be a communication take place with the UN, where there's a communication of the changing circumstances there more so than anything else, and a desire for the UN to review whether or not continued presence there is necessary. I don't think Ireland would be unilaterally pulling out of anything or anything like that. But I think there is certainly a question to be asked in light of the circumstances here.
Yeah, Declan, just to go back to a heartbreaking front story on the front of the Irish Mail, where they just had that last message, don't come back, it's too late. What would the impact on the defence family, like just even seeing all those photographs yesterday outside Aiken Barracks and Dundalk.
The unit, 27th Battalion, actually it's a former classmate of mine from cadet school days, Lieutenant Colonel Frank Coakley, that commands that unit. And I know that that's a member of their family, effectively, that has died, and community, an integral part. So they will feel that keenly. And that will be a sore on that unit going forward, and something that they won't forget. However, there's another element to this that we have to keep in mind. It's very easy to focus on the whole sympathy thing and nearly file it under tragic accident, which is what that kind of media campaign is taking place. But we also need to look a little bit internally, because there are also disturbing messages and words coming out through various channels to me, both serving and retired, about the preparation levels of Irish troops for going overseas. That particular battalion had problems in its form-up. Form-up is the preparation, deployment preparation that takes place. A lot of this is not to do with individual officers or non-commissioned officers and their competency. It's to do with capacity.
It's to do with
what Cathal Berry has been warning us about, the brain drain. Mm. The second in command of that battalion only arrived in country a few days ago. Now, the 2IC, as he or she is known, is the detail person to allow the commanding officer to focus on the broad picture. That's just an example. of the struggles that creates.
So it may lead to a broader debate that Cathal Berry, and to be fair, and others have brought up about resources for the Defence Forces. I'm going to take a quick break. Before I do, I just really just do want to say to Declan, I understand your passion that the Sunday Independent do have their own sources, and I have no reason to suspect that the story isn't accurate. So I just want
but I'd still be critical of it.
Yeah, and listen, and I appreciate your passion is coming right across. But look, I just want to say, just before we take, I didn't realise we'd been talking for so long. Let's take a very quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back. Well, whatever about Leo Varadkar returning as skipper in about 3 hours, just over 3 hours, the game that many of you have been waiting for, the World Cup final between France and Argentina, is going to take place. And I'm joined now by Gavin Cooney, sports journalist at the 42. I think you're at the stadium already, are you, Gavin?
Yeah, I am. Hi there. I am indeed. I'm sitting in the media centre here in the Lusail Stadium in the middle of the desert. I hope it's not too loud in the background, but if it is, listeners, just accept it as atmosphere ahead of the biggest show on earth.
Well, listen, we're only slightly jealous of you being over there. Ken Early was chatting just yesterday. He was saying it had been a bit of campaign had been a bit of no crack. But what's the atmosphere like there today?
Well, the atmosphere is pretty good around the final, obviously. Argentina are in the final. Their fans have been one of the few groups of supporters capable of generating an atmosphere of the games out here. And that's partly down to the fact that the Argentinian FA have paid to fly in supporters for this tournament. And to add some more momentum behind this almost kind of religious journey to the final for Lionel Messi.
Yeah, and really he is. He's just the big, big star of the show. I know, obviously, along with his PSG star, Kylian Mbappe, they're the big, big things. But really, this tournament, this game, is all about the 35-year-old, isn't it?
It really is. You know, it's a measure of the man that this is the biggest show on earth and it's still all really about him.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, football, the best stories in football derby are generally those that would be too hackneyed or too corny to survive any second draft in a writer's room in any other realm. But, however, the most seductive tale of them all in football could still be told today that Messi, on his final appearance on the world stage, might crown his legacy by winning the greatest prize and the only prize that has eluded him so far, which would also end the old Messi-Ronaldo debate. It would also allow Messi to kind of take his place in history with Diego Maradona as a kind of a neat, regal lineage. So yeah, it's very, very exciting, I gotta say.
It's almost as if people are willing it so, isn't it? They're almost willing it into existence for him personally, but also for the history books.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you, and I think that has to be the way, because France are the favourites for this final. They're the better team, and Messi will be the best player on the pitch. But in France, France have Kylian Mbappe, his Messi's teammate at Paris Saint-Germain, who too is a difference maker. Like, he can win this final on his own, in fairness. So, I mean, you know, all the build-up and everything is about Messi, but, you know, come, 2 hours after the final whistle, whatever time that is in Ireland, 5 or 6 o'clock this evening, don't be surprised if we are talking about the final accession of to the throne of Kylian Mbappe.
We were chatting extensively yesterday to Ken Early, as you know, about Qatar, about a lot of the controversy that has hung over this World Cup, you know, the amount of money, the investment, has it paid off? But even in the final, Qatar are winning because, of course, they are the backers of PSG, which is home to both Messi and Mbappe.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they wanted the world's eyes on them. That's what they've paid more than $200 billion to host this World Cup for Derby. And that's what they've got. You know, they've got the greatest show on earth here today. And the two stars of it, Kylian Mbappe and Lionel Messi, are on their payroll at the club that they own in Paris Saint-Germain. So they've won. Qatar have won, perhaps regrettably so. But when you've got that much money, you can't lose.
It's hard not to. Well, speaking of people who might be been for a bit of money, stay in the line with me, Gavin, as I go to Noel Rock. You put in an early bet on today's cup final, didn't you? Our World Cup final, Noel.
I did. I have Argentina for the tournament. You're outing
me now. What were the odds? Go on.
So yes, for reasons of emotion, as Gavin very eloquently outlined there, I really, really, really want to see Lionel Messi win this tournament. And so I thought I'd back it up with a very small, modest bet at 11-2. So fingers crossed. But my head, like Gavin's head, like Eamon Dunphy's head on the page 5 of the Sunday Independent today, says that unfortunately France probably do have the edge. But sometimes illogical things can happen in football, so fingers crossed.
Yeah, and I hear, Gavin, I heard a wee croak in your throat earlier, and there's been a bit of a flu ripping through Qatar as well, hasn't there?
Yeah, this croak, I can assure you listeners of my commitment to professionalism, this is not from shouting in the press box or anything like that. There's been a flu cutting its way through the press pack in Qatar, and also it has now affected some of the players. So France's lead up to this match has been hampered by the fact that players have struggled with flu. So Deo Upamecano and Adrien Rabiot missed the semi-final. They should be back today, but Raphael Varane, Ibrahima Konate and Kingsley Coman struggled in the build-up to this. So they all trained yesterday, so they should be ready to play, but how fit they are, we'll have to wait and see. So, you know, it's far from ideal preparations from France to suddenly have that issue in the camp.
But before I let you go, Gavin Cooney, with the 42, tell me, this is your job, call it, what's it going to be?
literally every prediction I've done has been wrong at this World Cup. But I'm going to commit, I mean, look, boring cliche alert, head says France, heart says Argentina. So let's say Argentina and almost try and manifest it and will it into existence.
Well, listen, we let you go back to that fantastic atmosphere, Gavin, from the 42. Thanks a million. There was a really interesting story. Was it by Luke O'Neill in the Sunday Independent? I don't know if anybody else saw it. He was talking about the benefits of supporting a football team. And he listed out five benefits, and which are quite good. Will I just see? Haven't even got my papers open. But it was really good. But just actually talking about kind of for mood boosting for everything. Will you be in there? Will you be singing and shouting today?
Well, yeah. So actually the piece that Niamh Horan talking to Eamon Dunphy in the Sindo mentions it as well. That's the beauty of football, and Eamon Dunphy quote, when there's hardship, it's escapism. So he was saying, you know, especially for Argentina, you know, their inflation rates are astronomical, and, you know, the country isn't in a great place, but that, yeah, the escapism and the distraction of something like football is great. So I will, I will keep an eye on it. I had great intentions to boycott this World Cup entirely, but
succeed.
I've been sucked in a little bit. I'll keep an eye.
There was a piece, Declan, just Luke O'Neill was reporting popular science. We're saying that it makes us feel less lonely. It gives us collective joy. It allows us to live in the moment. One of the key goals of Buddhist philosophy, he said. But he said, pick a team, cheer lustily, congratulate yourself on doing a World Cup of good. It'll be good as any workout or yoga session, and who knows, you might live long enough to see Ireland win the World Cup.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely right, and it's not restricted to football. I think any sport, certainly any team sport. I think perhaps soccer. I wouldn't be a mad soccer fan, but on the international level, I'd always, you know, pay attention to and support, because there is a whole kind of a bonding thing, and you know, it's great to be able to watch matches like that collectively as well. I mean, there's no comparison, and you don't have to be an aficionado. You don't have to have detailed knowledge to be able to enjoy it. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of Irish people probably were leaning towards Argentina, because one of the things that happens...
Definitely in Foxford, because
we dig up the old connections, don't we? You know, what harm? It adds
the founder of the Navy, I think they're having big messy parties if they went tonight. Gráinne, before we close, I just wanted to, or before we get up to 12 o'clock, there was a front page story on the Business Post, which was interesting. The government will consider capping prices on energy bills in a policy U-turn. Now, the big thing before the budget was that we weren't going to do this because there were all fears it could cause, you know, all sorts of market difficulties. What did you think of that story?
Extraordinary, because it is a massive U-turn. There were fierce debates in the Dáil where Sinn Féin were calling for this, and the government told them, the minister of the day would tell them that you want to be like the UK, who have this just basically unlimited, amount to energy companies who you're criticising. And we can't afford that, particularly because we guaranteed the banks. We would be very uneasy about doing anything like that, because it is guaranteeing the government paying energy companies no matter how high the prices go. But they're going to consider doing it now.
They said the move could cost billions of euro, but it's become a more attractive prospect after Germany pushed ahead with its own year-long price cap.
And so I think the distinction is really important. So, you know, the UK model was this unlimited cap on energy prices. It removed all incentives from individuals to reduce their energy consumption, which is really critical in the climate emergency. What's really different here is what they've done is they've asked the ESRI to assess what the German model would look like in an Irish context. And the German model is to guarantee a price for a portion of households and businesses' energy bills. So they're suggesting that they would set that based that portion based on last year's consumption. So that would maintain the incentives for people to reduce their usage and reduce their bills. Beyond that, you would pay whatever the market price is. So I suppose it's more cost effective than the UK model, which we saw markets reacted extremely badly to, and UK was downgraded as a result. But also, it really importantly, it conserves those incentives to reduce energy consumption.
Just to clarify, when Sinn Féin and other opposition parties were calling for it, they didn't just cite the UK. I think they cited the Netherlands and possibly, I'm not too sure, it might have been Spain actually, as well, who had done something similar. So there were other models that the government could have looked at if they wanted to introduce this earlier. I think this points to, because they talk about doing it for a year, yeah. I think this points to maybe them realising that the energy crisis is going longer term.
It's going longer,
They might need to do something in the new year. That's going to be the big crisis, big decision in the new year.
We know that like the one-off payments are most likely going to need to be repeated again next year. So, you know, that those low-income households in particular are going to need additional supports. You know, a lot was done in the budget, but it was all one-off basis.
And it's not going away.
And it's not
going
away.
Home heating bill yesterday was made to go by. Paddy Agnew, Gráinne, has an extraordinary piece in the Sunday Independent. A Qatar-related story, which sort of reads like the chapter of a book.
It does. And, you know, Gavin Cooney was on there. He's a former colleague of mine. He's a brilliant writer, and he just kind of makes things like the World Cup come to life. But talk about, Paddy Agnew does something very similar with Qatargate this week. And if you've missed it, it's a great catch up about how
extraordinary
it is. So it starts basically this, a vice president of the European Parliament. There's something like 14 of them. So one of the vice presidents, a Greek MEP called Eva Kalli, her father, it opens up the piece and it says her father was intercepted by Belgian police this week, and he had a wheelie bag with him and 600,000 euro in freshly printed banknotes was found in that bag. And he said he didn't know what was in it. He was just doing a favour for his daughter. And that opens up this kind of massive scandal, which Paddy Agnew says could be one of the worst the EU has ever known. He goes, there's kind of interesting little details. So of the four who have been charged, it goes into, I'm not going to name at the moment, but it's not really that important. But one of the partner of Kalli is also involved in this kind of scandal. And as an aside, the piece mentions that he was once voted the most handsome man in the European Parliament. So it talks about this kind of like showbiz kind of, you know, really interesting details. You know, they talk about this was alleged. This tip off about this came 2 years ago. It's happening. It's all broken to the fore this week.
Paddy Agnew said this is where the politically most controversial World Cup finals of modern times, played in the oil-rich Middle East, clashed headfirst into the world's most politically correct and easily infiltrated high-minded talking shop, namely the European Parliament of Strasbourg.
And then you have the Greek mythology of it being. So she said that she has no intention of following the faith of mythological figure Iphigenia, I can't pronounce that, who sacrificed herself in order to make the winds blow again. So you have all this kind of like dramatic pieces.
Noel Rock, we haven't forgotten about you there. It's one of the understated lines in Paddy Agnew's piece. It says, the system needs urgent reform.
Yeah, look, there's no question. I mean, this is the most eye-catching story I've seen at a European political level in many, many years. The idea of kind of relatively widespread, it would seem, money passing hands. The investigation has become quite extensive altogether. There's actually quite a large number of people being investigated as part of this. So it would seem as though reform is required in relation to, I suppose, standards in public office at a European level. Certainly at an Irish level, there are relatively rigorous kind of standards and assessments when it comes to lobbying. But at a European level, it seems as though if we were going back to our report card of earlier on, standards would be getting a bit of a D minus or an F here, I'm afraid.
Of course, the sheer scale of the population of Europe and all of that lobbying, it is, of course, a very intense thing. Well, look, that is all we have time for before we go to our break. I want to thank Gráinne Nié, Dublin reporter with the Press Association, Declan Power, security and defence analyst, Dr. Emma Howard, economist and lecturer at TU Dublin, and recovering with a little bit of COVID, Noel Rock, former Fine Gael TD, director of public affairs at Red Flag. Happy Christmas, and we'll take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.